Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy! They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine and More.
Blog Talk Radio.
Attention all stations. Conelrad has declared an alert emergency action message. Prepare to copy. Stand by all stations. Conelrad has declared Contra Radio Network is live and broadcasting. Stand by for this episode.
And good evening, Saturday night, December 12th. I'm John Jeffers, your host, founder, and executive producer here at the Contra Radio Network. All right, you're going to have to forgive me a little bit. I'm fighting off a wicked cold. So if I have to stop in the middle of something, then I will mute the mic and struggle to fight for air. Ha! All right. If you want to participate, you can. We've got four ways here at the Contra Radio Network for you to participate. You may hit the Skype button. It'll come right here. You may hit the chat room. It's open. You post it. I'll read it. Call in. Two lines. Two phone numbers. 516-453-9389. Or 855-355-8458. All right. Now, we're going to talk about who do you let in after the shit hits the fan. That's our first story, and I think it's kind of interesting. Got this from Preprazine.com. Preprazine.com. We've talked about this before. So let's talk about it again. Because it's important. It really is. So let's set the scene. The S has well and truly hit the fan. It could be a financial collapse, civil unrest, martial law, and it's time to batten down the hatches, escape to your bug-out location, or retreat to your bunker. Whatever your plans are for a shit-hits-the-fan scenario, there is one unavoidable element that you should plan for ahead of time to avoid a possible life-threatening decision or mistake when it really matters. What we're going to look at today is what do you do when other people come knocking. And as a side note, we've talked about this, especially for prepper leaders and your prepper groups. You have to make this decision. And you need to think about this decision before it happens, because the bottom line is this. No matter what you decide, somebody in your group's not going to be happy about it. And the group members have to understand that not all decisions are going to be a democratic one. If you don't want to have a quote-unquote command structure for your prepper group, to start your own. That's the bottom line. So we will look at each group of people in turn and propose some pros and cons to letting those people into your bunker to share your preps or turning them away empty-handed. Your family. First up, we have the immediate family members, mom, dad, sister, brother, and their kids, maybe even your grandparents, aunties, uncles, and cousins. It's a long list. It really is. That's a lot of people who may turn to you in the event of a disaster and ask, or even expect you to take them in, feed them, clothe them, give them water, and basically look after them because they didn't prepare. They were irresponsible, and now they want you to take care of them. Now, I know there are some of you out there who will scoff and say, that's an easy decision. They're your family, so you let them in. And I do agree with you. I certainly would, and many of you would too. However, there are those in the survival and prepper communities that would happily turn their backs on the family if they didn't have enough to keep them all alive. And that's the rub. Is this wrong? I don't know. All I know is that for me and the vast majority of you reading this, we'll open those doors and let them in. Heck, your parents brought you into this world. Are you really going to turn them away? I also believe there's some very logical thinking going on inside the heads of those that would turn them away. I mean, you have a small family of four. You've prepared enough supplies to last 6 months for those four people. If you let in just two people, you've immediately cut your survival time down drastically. You could even say by half. If your brother or sister turns up with their kids, you could be looking at reducing that 6 months down to a few weeks per person. Kind of makes you think, doesn't it? What about your friends? We all have friends. Some of us, you know, well, some of us are just as close, you know, see our friends just as often as we do our own family members. So it'll be hard for many of us to turn away our buddy of 20 years if he or she was to turn up after an event that caused people to panic, loot, riot, and cause harm to each other. The saving grace in this situation is that you are very likely to know your friends, their habits, their mindset, and if they will bring anything to the table. Survival could well and truly be a numbers game. So having an extra pair of hands around could help. If you're the only one in your family or group that can shoot, what happens when you get sick? You can't be on guard 24/7. You've got to sleep sometime. And you got to eat and use the bathroom. Have another adult or two, especially ones you know so well, can put your mind at ease and allow for as normal existence as possible after a critical event. Personally, I have a mental list of my friends. They each have a tick or a cross to indicate who will get in and who won't. They are ranked based on what they could bring to the table, such as the right mindset, physical or mental abilities, and even just having the right attitude. Is it time for you to run through your friends and decide who is likely to show up, who gets in, who gets the boot? How about neighbors? Your neighbors may actually be the first people to show up on your doorstep if they have chosen to bug in or go underground to your bunker. They are likely to be the first tough decision you have to make, and I think this section will split you down 50-50 down the middle. Hold on just one moment. I told you, if I have to hack, I'm going to put on mute, do my thing, and come back to you. Right, let's get back to it. Okay. You see, half of us get on fire with our neighbors. We have them around for dinner, lend each other garden tools. The other half of us argue with them about parking situation out front or the overhanging tree branches that you don't want in your garden or how much noise they make. This is why I think you'll also be an easier decision, as you either like your neighbors or you don't. It's also likely you're aware of their mindset and if they prepared themselves or not. Ever get funny questions about what it is you're doing in that garage and what's all that, security cameras, etc.? Small conversation topics like those could be an inroad to the mindset of your neighbor. And to find out what he, she is really like, and how likely it is they have a grip on their family's survival. Now, how about strangers? When it comes to strangers, the vast majority of you will take the stop or I will shoot approach. Some will be hidden away or at a retreat away from people and traffic. I myself would likely take this approach too. I mean, you don't know or trust that person walking in the park, let alone the guy with no food and a family to feed. However, I want to bring up an alternative. Something that would make me question my initial response, perhaps let them in after all. Say a guy and his wife with their small child comes around. They see you grabbing last-minute stuff from the garage, and he asks if he can hole up in your place as their home was burnt down by rioters and looters. His wife is sitting in the truck. The bed is full with containers, backpacks, camping gear. You can see he has a rifle on his shoulder and a pistol on his belt, but he has his hands raised, so he means no harm. He tells you they have brought everything he's been tucking away in his garage for a rainy day like today. They have enough food, water, and ammunition to protect themselves, but no shelter or friends or family in the area as they have just moved into town. So what would you do? Me, I would talk to him some more, ask to see his preps, quiz him on how long he thinks the food and water would last and what skills he and his wife have. More importantly, I'd ask what he does for a living and where they relocated from to get an idea of the kind of terrain they are used to. I would meet his kids and ask him some simple questions about mommy and daddy, what happened to their house. Kids are terrible liars. The younger they are, the easier it is to spot. You could also get a feeling of how scared he is, or what he or she has been saying, or other little signs. Unprepared. Let's flip this now. Same family. Turn up. With nothing, you know, nothing with him. Doesn't even have a weapon. Just open hands and a wife and a kid. Do you stick to your original thought out plan or of turning them away? Telling them you have, you know, only enough for a few days for your family and you'll be leaving soon. Perhaps a show of force with your weapon clutched and ready to go. Let me propose this. What if I just had a conversation with him? Okay. You can see he has no physical goods to offer. However, he tells you he has his own business, hand building log cabins, and his wife is a nurse. Would that change your mind? He clearly has good hands-on skills. Perhaps he could help board up the windows, fell trees, or for firewood, or fix doors, or other items. His wife, being a nurse, has great skill set that would be in great demand. You have a first aid kit. You practice a little, but that's not going to be enough if you lose a limb or a family member gets injured. So what other skills would be useful? Would it all depend on the situation, of course? Well, sure. Here are just a few ideas off the top of my head. You want firearms experience, medical training, procuring food and water, which is hunting and foraging, cooking, electrical and mechanical training, animal husbandry, primitive weapon making. There are many more skills that, as a group of preppers in a shit-hits-the-fan scenario, could benefit from. There is safety in numbers, and it may not be ideal or realistic to think that just yourself, your wife, and two kids can, you know, stay alive, fend off the bad guys, and survive whilst the rest of the world falls to pieces. So, I hope this article has made you think more about questions first and shooting later. Snap decisions are often made in life, and by preparing, you are one step of many steps ahead of the curve. So, taking the time to stop and think, what if, could literally be the difference in your family's survival. And that's, you know, I think that's pretty good. I think that's, realistic. Those are things you're going to have to ask. It's that simple. All right, I'll be right back.
Do you have a wedding, birthday, graduation, holiday party, or other special event coming up? Would you like to impress your friends or coworkers with your own personal bar and bartender? Professional Beverage Service is Northeast Illinois and Southeast Wisconsin's premium beverage service provider. We specialize in providing bars and bar service for all of your event needs. From simple to elegant, a small home party of 25 to a corporate event of 1,000 or more. Need help finding the right appetizers, meals, transportation, DJs, or even hotels? Professional Beverage Service can help with all of your needs. With free event planning services, Professional Beverage Service will make your event a one-of-a-kind, hassle-free success. From big to small, Professional Beverage Service can handle it all. Call 847-899-5594 or go to www.bevservice.com for more details.
Now back to the program.
All right. Here's one that we have to talk about. It's not pleasant, but it's going to be a fact. What do you do with the dead bodies? The topic of death is not on. It's not one you will hear at parties or even in many private conversations. Many people, including me, do not even like thinking about death. It is a subject that we should give consideration to and hope we only need to deal with it on a limited basis. Death would be more difficult to cope with, not having properly trained people to guide us through the journey. So, during a disaster, where normalized living conditions are expected soon, you should place the deceased in a protective area, preferably in as cold an environment as possible. Wrap the body to prevent bodily fluids from leaking. Documentation is critical to be able to prove how death occurred. Investigations into deaths may happen, and you must be able to provide all evidence possible to any authorities of circumstances revolving around the passing. Any pictures, documentation, eyewitness statements will be helpful. You'll be required to take some very important steps in a situation where societal normalcy is expected to occur in a relatively short period of time. You want to protect yourself from unwarranted investigations into the death of any individuals or loved ones. Possible environmental disasters might be one of those types of situations. If you recall, after Hurricane Katrina, there are investigations into the death of individuals in hospitals and the possible prosecution of healthcare workers who are suspected of allowing inpatients to die. None of the workers are found guilty, but it could have made a different outcome. Documentation will be of the utmost importance. All right. There's a great deal of information. And if you go to the CRN Facebook page, you'll see this article. Click on it. All right. Situations. What should you do if someone dies? Now, a lot of these things are going to be, if possible. A lot of them may not be possible, but if possible. Hold on one. So, document the event, date, time, day of week. Where did the death take place? Actual number of victims, fatalities, location of bodies. Pictures are 1,000 words, literally. Accessibility of the disaster site, location of holding area for the bodies, estimated time to recover the bodies, or estimate the time it took to recover the bodies, condition of bodies, presumed identity, list any potential hazards you encountered at the site, document the weather condition, list the people involved in recovering the bodies, how to make identification easier for family members and authorities, note the color of the skin, hair, eyes. Are there any distinctive moles, scars, tattoos, birthmarks, or any type of physical abnormalities? Approximate age and weight. If a camera is available, take pictures. Remember, pictures are 1,000 words, literally. And when you take pictures, if you have to, start at the head at the 12 o'clock position and take pictures from the clock, from around the clock angle. So you'd step to your left, that's 1 o'clock, step again, 2 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, you should be standing at their left forearm taking pictures. And don't do, you can do close-ups, you need close-ups, and you do some back ones so people can see the background behind you, like you said. There might be investigations afterwards. And the more pictures you have, the better it is for you. All right? If relatives are able to identify the body, write down any additional information they can provide. Place an identity tag on the body. Make sure you protect yourself. This is important, too. Use face masks. Make sure your mouth and eyes are also covered. Wear gloves, protective clothing, and thick-soled shoes or boots. If you have any sores or scratches, cover them with waterproof bandages. If a person dies from a known contagious disease, additional care should be taken in handling the dead body. There can be risks such as hepatitis B and C, HIV, TB, and diarrheal disease. If a death occurs when there is little hope of life returning to normalcy anytime soon or at all, such as a societal breakdown, you will need to take additional steps. If you are dealing with family members in a disaster such as the end of the world as we know it, you most likely will know if your family has any of the above diseases. You should also document the progression of any illness that caused a death. You will want to document, as described above in the section titled, What You Should Do If Someone Dies. Now, in addition, the body will need to be properly buried. There's a common thought that bodies should be buried 6 feet deep. This originated in England during the plague in London back in 1665. The depth of 6 feet was thought to prevent others from contracting the plague. They did not understand the body did not pose a threat of spreading the plague. The plague was spread by infected fleas. In the 1800s, this practice requiring bodies to be buried 6 feet deep was lifted. The lifting of the law did not last long. Medical science began using cadavers from criminals, the poor, and donated bodies. The need for additional bodies gave rise to the business of corpse stealing. Grave robbers could easily dig up bodies that were buried at a shallow depth with as little as 6 inches over the body. The 6 foot burial returned. Today, the depth of a burial varies on a state-by-state basis. Many states require only 18 inches over the top of a body to be covered. Most people will not know what their state's requirement is. It would then become an individual decision on depth of burial. How strong is your back? Use a rope in lowering the body into the ground or bring a bucket if you've done a significantly deep hole so that you can get out. Now, conditions of environment should be considered to make sure the body is buried deep enough to keep animals from digging it up. If a handmade casket is made, holes should be made in the bottom, allowing groundwater to enter, helping to prevent the casket from popping out of the ground. In Louisiana, where flooding can be a problem, the caskets were weighted down to keep the caskets under the ground. Got it? If someone passes away during the winter where you cannot dig a proper grave, make sure you keep the body in a very secure, protected area and well-wrapped in a shroud or a tarp. Once you can bury the deceased, locate an area that is away from your water source and away from your home. If you have enough land, you should start a cemetery area for future burials. You will also want to make sure the graves are properly marked. This will serve as an identification of the grave should you have to show authorities where the deceased is buried if society is reestablished, and to show family members where their loved ones are located. I see guest 1878 has logged on. Welcome to CRN. It is important to make sure the religious practices of the deceased are honored for both the family and their loved one. This could help family members grieve and adjust to the loved one's passing. In a time of chaos, stress will be high, and the death of a loved one will escalate the anxiety. This stress can produce more psychological situations a family or group may need to deal with. Death is not an easy thing to cope with, even the best of times. Well, it isn't. I mean, it is not a subject that most people even want to think about. It is, however, an important aspect of life. It should become a part of your preparedness plan. So the next time the hearse goes by, death is such a serious, difficult subject. All right. So when I was about 10 years old, my two best friends and I used to sing an abbreviated song about death. We didn't get all the words correct. We thought the song was "The Next Time the Hershey's Fly." However, it was actually "The Next Time the Hearse Goes By." I never did know what a Hershey was, but now I have the actual song to hear, and you'll understand. So, the version is, the next time the hearse goes by, don't you laugh, or you may die. They'll bury you 6 feet deep, and they'll leave you there for the worms to eat. The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. The worms play pinochle on your snout. Your stomach turns to slimy green, and pus comes out like whipping cream. They eat your eyes, they eat your nose, they eat your goob between your toes. And me without a spoon. There you go. That's what you do with dead bodies and why it's important. Because, look, if it goes to hell, like the perfect example was Katrina, lots of people died, some needlessly perhaps. But regardless, when they reestablished the government, they came asking, where are these people? Where are they buried? How did they die? And unless you have that information, you're going to be screwed. You're going to be holding the bag. All right. Let me see here. Hey, let me take a quick break. I'll be right back. Like I said, I'm fighting this rotten, wicked cold. So in between breaks, I'm doing what I got to do so we can get to the next story. And the next story we're going to do is setting up an EOC for your prepper group. You're saying, what's an EOC? It's an Emergency Operations Center. We'll be right back.
The 11th American Preparedness Group, the 11th APG, is looking for members both locally and nationally. Based in Western Lake County, Illinois, the group is looking for new and experienced preppers to join the group. If you'd like more information, email the 11th APG at contraradio@live.com, contraradio@live.com, or for more information, check the Contra Fighter Word blog at contrafighter.wordpress.com. That is all.
Now back to the program.
All right. All right. Set up the EOC for your prepper group. Oh, before I forget, that last story we did came from the BlueJeanMama.com, BlueJeanMama.com. This one is by the sergeant. And we picked that up on AmericanPreppersOnline.com. Okay. Setting up an EOC for your preppers group. Setting up an EOC, Emergency Operations Center, for your prepper group should be at the top of your group's activities. When the shit hits the fan, you're going to need a centralized base of operations for disseminating information to your members. This could be everything from weather information to road closures and possibly even troop movements. Waiting until the shit hits the fan and then scrambling to figure out just how to set one up is a recipe for disaster, and one that could be avoided by good planning. Now, this is a topic for today's post, all right? The first question may be, what exactly is an ELC, and why does my preferred group need one? The answer to those two questions is really very simple. An ELC is a centralized source for information that is gathered from many sources and compiled by your group's members. The reason for the emergency would dictate the type of information that would be needed by your members. If it was weather-related, for example, they might need information for road closures in flooded areas as well as storm updates. If it is caused by an attack on the U.S. of some type, then you may need to update your group or where the troops are, the best routes to avoid them or get to them, depending on what the case is. A chemical attack would necessitate the need for information on wind speed and direction. I think you get the point as to why your group needs to have, needs to have one, or just how important it could be when the time comes. Now let's take a look at choosing the best location for your EOC. If your group has a clubhouse, not one in a tree, or a particular home where you regularly meet, then that may be the best place to create it. This is only if the location will not need to be evacuated for flooding or is not situated in any place that could place the occupants in a dangerous situation. The best place in my mind to locate one would be in the home of someone who intends to bug in for a shit hits the fan situation. Some place with both wired and wireless phones, as well as cable TV and internet access. In other words, it needs to have as many forms of gathering and sending information as possible. It should have backup electrical systems in case the power goes out, as well as several maps of the area for locating alternate routes. Quick note, if you're with these maps, you need to get the 50,000 to 1 scale. Those are the military-grade maps, 50,000 to 1. You can get them online. They're cheap. They're very cheap. They're very affordable. All right. Where were we? Oh, yes. So, where you locate is up to you, but I would recommend that it should be placed someplace that's manned at all times if possible, like maybe the home of a retired member of your group, for instance. The next question after you have decided where you'll put your EOC is to decide what to keep in it. And we have several recommendations. Besides the obvious, such as phones, TVs, maps, there are a few other items you should add, such as a good HF, which is high frequency, ham radio for receiving and sending information over large areas of the country. No, you don't need a large tower to be able to talk for long distances, as a simple wire antenna strung up in a tree close by will do just fine in most cases. You may want to add a VHF, very high frequency radio, for communicating with your group locally in the event cell phone coverage is out. Another item is a good computer connected to the internet with multiple monitors for monitoring several things at once. You'll want to identify several key road intersections and have traffic cams bookmark them. If you need to access them in a hurry, you'll also want to bookmark several trusted news stations, both local and national as well. When a disaster strikes, you need the information in a hurry, you'll be glad you took the time to do it in advance rather than try to do it on the run, because that's when mistakes happen. I would also bookmark other sites, such as local weather radar and the National Weather Service, for example. Maybe a site with information on surviving a nuclear blast or a chem attack would be handy to have, too. Anything you could possibly need to know in a hurry. Okay, so now you have your EOC set up. How do you use it? And an emergency should be your next question. Just give me a moment here. I swear this cold. I think my wife gave it to me. I think I'm going to have to punish her for that. Yeah. All right, get back to it. All right. So how do you use it? This is a really hard one because it depends on exactly what the emergency is. In this case, we should just look at from a high level that might apply to as many situations as possible. First off, the overarching goal here is to gather and provide your members with as much information on the ongoing emergency as possible in a usable format. This means that if it's weather-related, then you may need to provide weather information first. Always place the most important information at the beginning of your update, just in case you lose contact with them before you can provide all the information you intend to. In any given emergency, the most important information will be that which will allow the members of your group to safely reach their retreat or to provide safety information for those who are bugging in. The power of this type of information should never be underestimated, as I've said before. This should be the highest priority for your group. Even if your group is only planning to meet at a stop somewhere before going their separate ways, getting them there safely is the first key to survival. So discussing this in detail well in advance of an emergency and taking the time to plan out and set up the group's EOC is well worth the effort. Until such time as an emergency occurs, all we can really do is prepare, plan, and practice for every possible scenario we can think of. Plan ahead, plan to survive. All right, that's about it for this post. I hope you've enjoyed it because it is a good idea. And I hope it gives you something to think about or maybe a few new ideas for getting ready. Until next time, just remember that keep prepping is a direction of travel, not a destination. So keep on prepping, folks. That's from the Sergeant at American Preppers Online. American Preppers Online. All right. Let's see, what else? What are the stories I say we're going to do? We talked about who you will and will not let into the group once the critical event passes. We've talked about that. One I told you we were going to talk about. 20 rules to win a firefight. And where did we get this from? USCrow.org. USCrow.org. All right. Now, we are going to go over the top 20 firefight rules for any warfighter to live by. In this day and age of high-speed drills, the tactical gear, we can often lose sight of essential firefight rules, fogging up the basics and getting your ass in a world of hurt. With this in mind, we are going to talk about 20 bedrock rules anyone who will end up in a firefight should know. Focus on these rules first and foremost. Worry about looking cool later. That's true. Okay. You don't have to write these down. That's all written down for you. Go to the Contra Radio Network Facebook page. Look for the 20 rules for firefights. You can then, do the highlight, copy, paste thing. And it's all written down for you. Number one, ditch style for the kill. I know you guys all love Travis Haley focusing on your stance and strategy. The reality is, in a firefight, all that shit goes out the window and no one will give a damn about your stance, tactics, or caliber. The one thing that matters is who lives and who dies. If you have to operate dirty for the kill, do it. Two, communicate, communicate, communicate. Here's the one thing, you've never been in a firefight, but if you're an avid airsoft or a paintballer, you're still going to be surprised how communication sounds in an actual firefight. There'll be confusion, frustration, and a mashup of fuck, reloading, where the fuck did that come from, contact, moving. Number three, make sure they stay dead. Said it a million times before, and I'll say it again. Ammo is cheaper than your life. Never forget the Mozambique technique. You put two in their chest and one in their hard drive. That means their head. It's also called a body armor drill. A big mistake a lot of people make is thinking a center mass shot will put you down, will put down your target. Reality is they can keep moving long enough to plug you a couple of times. Number four, keep your distance. Find cover and shoot. If at all possible, keep your distance from your target using lateral or diagonal movement to get to bulletproof cover. No, before you even think about it, I'm not talking about car doors. They are not bulletproof. Concrete, stone, 10-inch thick bricks work very well as cover. Once you find cover, shoot. Number five, there is no honor in a firefight. If you're in a firefight with some preconceived notion of an honorable duel, you're going to get your ass handed to you. Instead, play dirty, do whatever you have to gain the tactical advantage and get the kill. Number six, pucker factor for the kill. You may think that accuracy will get you the kill in a firefight, but in reality, more often than not, the pucker factor will get you the kill. Basically, extreme fear is going to make your butthole tighten up and your actions will become panic. At the end of the day, accuracy is a relative term. Translate that for you. He who puts more lead downrange wins. Okay, there you go. Never go into a firefight with a pistol or low caliber rifle. If you have a choice, never go to a firefight with a pistol. and never go to a firefight chambered anything less than 5.56 millimeter, 7.62 NATO, or 6.8. Anyone who tells you a 22 long rifle caliber rifle is just as good a caliber for a firefight is completely full of shit, and it would take a very skilled marksman to get a kill shot with a 22 long rifle in a firefight. Your pistol is only a backup and should only be used after all of your ammo for your primary weapon has been exhausted. Number 8, you're not a ninja. You aren't. Ditch the knives, swords, and nunchucks for a gun. A lot of the guys I talk to are often brainwashed by this Hollywood horseshit, where you see Jason Statham in The Expendables getting in a knife fight every 10 seconds. But again, the reality is your knife will rarely come out to do anything else than cut paracord and eat your food. Number 9, prioritize your ammo. This is important. If you're going to a firefight or traveling through an area where you know you will encounter enemy forces, prioritize ammunition above all else. Bring 3 times the ammo you think you'll need because you have no idea how much you're going to be hating life when your ammo is gone. 75% plus of your load better be ammo. Number 10, have a plan. Have a backup plan. When going into a firefight, have a clear objective with a well-organized plan that will get you the tactical advantage. That being said, 10 seconds into a firefight, plan A will be shot to shit, so you better have a backup plan for when everything goes to hell. Number 11, stay on guard, also called relaxing too soon. Never drop your guard. Do a 360 scan for threats at all times. Even after you know you dropped a target, you and your unit need to secure the area, maintain situational awareness at all times, or someone is going to pop up from behind a wall to punch your time card. Number 12, flank when possible. Any untrained combatant will succumb to their fear and will get tunnel vision, focusing what's directly in front of them, while trained operators know to do a 360-degree scan. Flanking will not only, sideblind the enemy, but will force them to redeploy to face the new threat, causing confusion, making their goals more difficult. With this in mind, you should always guard your own flanks. Number 13, life over morality. Many of you will be faced with ethical conundrums of whether it is right to shoot this person or if you are justified in taking another person's life. Get out of here with that mentality. This is a cruel world where we live in, and I'd rather be bummed out than dead. Number 14, be fast. God, they use that stupid term. Okay. Before I really go off, hold on. All right. Speed loading, and I hate this term, tactical reloading, no such thing, both have their advantages and disadvantages. But regardless of which technique you employ, know this. The faster you finish a battle, the less people will shoot at you. Number 15. Never use an unreliable gun. You never want to go into a firefight with an unreliable weapon. To do so is almost assuring you a quick death. Stress test your rifle in the rain, in dirt, mud, and any other grimy situation you can contrive. Don't worry, you can clean it later. The idea is to see if your rifle is going to fail you once it gets some gunk in the works. That's important. Number 16. Not all firefights are in the day. True. Almost every video or picture you find of people actively trained for firefights are in the middle of the day with optimal lighting conditions. Again, be realistic. You will have a firefight at night, and you need to be prepared for that. Number 17, be more aggressive and faster than your enemy. In any firefight, the primary rule you must employ at all times is to be more aggressive and to be faster than your enemies. By keeping your tempo higher than theirs, you will maintain a mental tactical advantage. 18. If it's on the ground, it better be empty. If your enemy finds your weapon, it better be completely out of ammo. You never drop your weapon if it has ammo. Number 19, faces lie. No matter what a person is saying to you or how big their smile is, they could very well be planning to kill you. Watch their hand movements for any threatening gestures. And, or, if they are reaching for something and immediately draw down upon them before you end up dead. And last, and most importantly, listen to General Mattis, United States Marine Corps. And he says, be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet. There you go. Your 20 rules for how to win a firefight. All right, there you go. As I said, I'm fighting this wicked cold, and I got all the information I wanted to get out to you guys. I hope you guys appreciate it. And thank you again for listening on iTunes. Please rate the show. I'd really appreciate it. It'd make my life a lot easier. I appreciate it. The ratings, the listenership keeps going up and up. We're now on Stitcher. You can listen to hear us now on Stitcher, which is an app that has been, what's the word I'm looking for? It's an app that's really made for mobile devices. Your phone, your smartphone, whatever. We're on Stitcher now. Just got word on it 2 days ago. We're on player.fm. We're on Pocket Cast. We're on iTunes. We're on tunein.com. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah. Yeah, right here on blogtalkradio.com. So, I want to say thank you again for listening. I'm going to go grab something hot to drink to try to keep fighting this cold. This is horrendous. I will see you Wednesday, or we'll do the show again Wednesday, 8 p.m., another episode of the Roundtable Report, and we're going to do some talking about some things. I want you, and you can participate. We'd love to have callers in there. Love for you to listen in. Come and stop by and listen to us. And yes, we will let the jackassery fly, because that's what we do. And you know what? It's okay. It's fun. We need, and plus, you know, if you're not having fun while you're learning, you're not going to learn. You're going to say, oh, God, not these idiots again. Instead, join the jackassery and be cracking it up with us and having a good time, and you'll be learning stuff before you even realize it. That's the beauty of this. So thank you again for listening to Contra Radio Network. I've been your host, John Jeffers. Thank you, guest. Guest 1878. Thanks for checking in. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you then Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. Until then, be safe, be alert, be vigilant. Talk to you then. Good night.
Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy. They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine & More.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in store or online at TotalWine.com.